This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
All right. Let's do this.
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
And good Friday to you. Thanks for joining us. It is Wake Up Call on Sports Map Radio. Game 4 is tonight in Miami as the Nuggets and the Heat battling out once again. Very short break between the two games. But Denver leading this series 2-1, but they're leading by a lot more. There is a sense now that the Denver Nuggets are in control of this series, despite just being up 2-1, and despite the fourth game in a 7-game series, the most valuable and most important. Because if the Miami Heat sum up any energy or any fortitude, if they shoot 50% from three again, if they hit their shots, if they go for loose balls, if they battle the Nuggets for rebounds, and pull this off tonight, we've got a series again. It is a tied up at 2, best 2 out of 3, with 2 of the games being in Denver, place that Miami had already won before. So it would be a series. But why aren't people thinking it that way? Well, because of the way Denver has played in this series compared to Miami. There is no question, and I've said this many times, that the Miami Heat, as an 8 seed making this run, is one of the greatest playoff runs any team has ever made, given their circumstance. This was a team, and we talked about this with Eric Reed just the other day, about this team being a up and down, I don't know what the regular season means kind of basketball team. Their shooting was terrible. But then they get to the playoffs. They have to utilize the play-in tournament. They lose their first game. They win against Chicago to advance as an 8 seed, and the rest is history. They controlled the series against Milwaukee. They controlled the series against the Knicks, and they did lead 3-1 against Boston before the Celtics tied up the series, and then 3-0 to Boston, and then the Celtics tied up the series, and then they had to win Game 7 in Boston. But the Denver Nuggets are a basketball team that has been on top of the Western Conference for a good majority of the season. And they have got the best player in the game in Nikola Jokic. And they've got the best second wingman in the game in Jamal Murray. This combination has been unbeatable. Think about what happened in Game 2. Both of those guys had a 30-point triple-double. It is the first time in NBA history that a team had 2 players with 30-point triple-doubles. That includes the regular season. That means on a Tuesday night in January in 1992, the top team in the NBA didn't get that against the worst team in the NBA. It didn't happen in 1983. It didn't happen in 1975. It didn't happen in 2003. Kobe and Shaq didn't pull one off at any point that they were together. Michael and Scottie didn't pull it off at any point that they were together. Larry and Kevin McHale didn't do it, or Larry and Robert Parrish, or Magic and Kareem. Think of the best combinations in the NBA. No one ever pulled that off. But here's the great thing about what they did. Had it been on a Tuesday in February, where the number one team in the NBA against the worst team that's tanking, if that had occurred, we'd still go, wow, that's kind of wild. Those two did it on the biggest stage you could possibly do it on. Game 3 of the NBA Finals, where more attention was placed on that game because of what Miami did in Game 2. Winning in Denver, evening the series at 1. Now people are like, yeah, maybe there is something to this. And those two put on a show that had never been done before. I get it with the Heat. I do. I get it. What they've done is incredible. It's amazing. But the way I'm seeing the narrative is, well, if Miami does this, this, and this, are we really talking about that with an 8 seed against a 1 seed that is different than anybody they've played so far in the playoffs? I'm not saying this series can't be won by Miami. Lord knows I've seen too many things in sports. But my gut instinct is that the time is up. This Cinderella story is coming to an end, and it is a great Cinderella story. It is one of the best in NBA history. For a team with that record to face elimination in the play-in tournament, a recently created thing to allow teams to have more opportunities to make the postseason than they're in the bottom of a conference, They're playing the Chicago Bulls. Winner gets the Bucks. Loser is done. And look what they've turned that into. They not only turned that into a finals appearance where they knocked off the two top teams in the Eastern Conference, they turned it into a narrative where people are wondering, what is Miami doing wrong? How about the fact that they're just playing the best team in the NBA? How about they're just playing against the best player in the league? The best two-man combination in the league? A coach that has more at his disposal right now. Spoelstra is a genius, but sometimes you can't win it every single time. That's what I feel like it's more about. Miami needs to do this, and Miami needs to do that. Denver is just better. They're just better. Nikola Jokic could go down in history as one of the greatest players in the history of the game. He could go down in history as one of the greatest centers to ever play the game. And that list includes Bill Russell, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. It includes Shaq. He could go down in history as one of the greatest to play that position, not just because of his ability to score, his ability to grab rebounds. It's his ability to pass. I said this throughout the postseason as a kid that kind of grew up in the 80s and seeing basketball played a certain way. I have yet to see a big man pass the basketball like Nikola Jokic passes the basketball. He is a guard in a 7-foot body. But it's not that those guys couldn't do it, the Russells and Kareem and those. It's not that it's that the game didn't want them to do it. If you could get the ball to Shaq, Shaq's number one job was to score. It wasn't to dish it out to somebody else. The whole purpose was to get it to your big man in the paint. But with Jokic, they use him as a big man and they use him as a facilitator on offense for everybody else. The fact that he had 20 assists, you know, whatever, I mean, not 20 assists, 13 assists in game two, game one, I should say, really showcased that skill. He is a player that is historic. And there's nothing wrong with saying that maybe, just maybe, Miami is out of gas. I was watching a PTI yesterday, and Michael Wilbon, who's been covering this series for ABC, ESPN, you know, the studio guy with Stephen A. and everybody, he was going off about Miami, right? He was going off about this series, and he said, you know, I can't discount the Heat, because this is the time that we've seen in the postseason where we discount them. And I thought to myself, wait, hold on. When have we discounted Miami? They've led and controlled every series that they've been in. They've never trailed 2-1. Tell me where we went, all right, now the Miami Heat are done. They took the first two games against Milwaukee. They led, they controlled the series against the Heat. They took the first three games against the Celtics. We've never seen the Heat come back from this. What they did against Boston was they went up 3-0, lost three games, and then won in Boston. That's a great achievement. But they didn't rally back from a series. They controlled every series that they've been in. We cannot forget that, because it's an easy sports narrative to think that Cinderella is always a fighting an uphill battle. The Miami Heat were not fighting an uphill battle against Milwaukee. If anything, they made the uphill battle against their opponent. You have to overcome Giannis not being 100% and the fact that your coach is making dumb decisions. You're going to have to come off playing without intensity, New York, and without a sense of urgency, because when you didn't, we took advantage of that and beat you at the Garden. You're going to have to come off a 3-0 deficit, Boston, when your star players can't step up and take control of a game. And you finally get back to Boston with momentum, and you still can't find a star that can overcome your shortcomings when Jason Tatum falls down. Miami has put the onus on their opponent to do something. They put their onus on the opponent to rally back against them. They've never had to rally for them until now. Now is the time they're doing it. Now is the time that Spoelstra is looking for answers. Now is the time that they have to create something. Now is the time they're going to have to figure out how they're going to beat Denver at home to make this a series where it's tied up at two. And that has a lot to do with Denver. I have been picking on the city of Denver for whining and crying about the lack of media attention. It's an irrelevant thing. It doesn't make your life better. If you win the championship, nobody takes it away. Nobody says it's less than. And who cares what people think in the first place? But the reality of it is, when everybody is looking at the Miami Heat and saying, well, what's wrong with the Heat, rather than, you know, maybe, just maybe, they're not going to be able to beat a team as well-built as this. And I want to question, if the Miami Heat were facing Steph Curry in Golden State, would we be talking about this? If they were facing LeBron and the Lakers, would we be talking like this? Would we be looking at Miami and going, well, you know, they just got to do this, this, and this? Or would we be saying, you know, sometimes you run into the team of destiny. Sometimes you run into the team that everything is working for. Sometimes you run into the team that just matches up with you perfectly, and you just can't do it. You can't put out that kind of effort every single night in a seven-game series. We said it after game two, for crying out loud, when we looked at game two and we said, you know what? That's the best game we're going to see Miami play, and they still almost lost it. It's not that far-fetched to say, try it with me, that Denver's the best team in basketball. And if you're going to beat them, you got to be more than great. And maybe Miami is just out of gas after being really great for the entire postseason. All right, but if there is an answer to this, what is it? We'll go to some of the keys that Miami is going to have to do for tonight's game four. We also get some other things, including some baseball I want to get to, because everybody's screaming about one team in particular. That's coming up this hour.
You're listening to Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us. We continue with his Wake Up Call. By the way, we don't do Throwback Friday, right? We, you know, but every now and then we do mention a big anniversary date. Today is a huge one. It's the 50th anniversary of Secretariat winning the Belmont.
I watched it this morning.
Yeah, it is wild, isn't it? I love watching it. I love watching it. I had it as a Facebook post, so this morning when I was checking Facebook memories, I watched it again. It's remarkable. It's remarkable. It is. People say it's the greatest athletic achievement by any athlete. Well, I don't want to go that far,
this is the way to do it, because one article I read said, you know, everyone always debates all the greatest of all time in each other's sport.
Right.
You know, I mean, we can make a debate on basketball. I mean, MJ or LeBron, or football, baseball. You can go on and on and on. There is no debate when it comes to horse racing.
No, there isn't. No, there is no debate.
And this race is clear proof.
He's still, Secretariat still has the record at the Belmont. I mean, it's like all 50 years that they've run that race with all the new advancements and whatnot. They haven't, no horse has ever beaten that time.
Well, you know, the thing I was thinking about too, because I don't know the horse's name. I can't remember the one that was with him on the first turn.
That was, goodness gracious. It's on the tip of my tongue.
I'm sorry to do that to you.
Oh, my God. I got to look it up now.
If you watch the race, there's a horse that's with them, stride for stride, even a little bit ahead coming out of that first turn. And, you know, just like a nose length ahead of Secretariat. And all I could think about was, did that guy think for a second, oh, my God, I got this?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly.
Just, I mean, because, you know, they're
sham.
Sham.
Yeah, it just came to me.
You know, they're in the front straight away when they first start off. I mean, Secretariat has to come back from a little from behind. I mean, he's not that far behind. I mean, he's like sitting in fourth when they first start off. And then around that first turn, I mean, he's neck and neck. And then all of a sudden, I don't even know what gear Secretariat put it in. And then he's just gone.
It's so remarkable. I know we've talked about this, where it just feels like it's a lone horse on the racetrack. Like he doesn't belong there. You know, like somebody let out a horse down the stretch and the horse is ahead And you're like, get that horse. They're coming. Get that horse off the track.
Or
he's
or
that far just, ahead.
They grabbed all these other horses that weren't racehorses.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's incredible. I knew a lot of horse racing guys in Vegas, and I got to know some of them really well. One of them did a show at the station that I was at every single day. And they would talk to me about horses and horse racing, and one was a former jockey, and he told me, he goes, man, I don't care what anybody says. These horses, they know what they're doing. They know where they're at. They know what their job is, and some of them are up for the competition. I can't speak to that personally. I just take their word for it. They've been around the horses. But the evidence of that, to me, is watching this Belmont race. It's like Secretary had enough of this and went, All right, bye. I'm leaving now, and you all can be behind. Like, you just watch it and you know that it's a horse that's like, I know who I am and I know who all of you are, and I'm taking off and that's it. See you later. And the call, like a tremendous machine, it's so forceful. It's such a great call.
Well, I mean, the only debate left in that for that race was how many lengths did he win by?
Right. Oh yeah.
Now,
oh,
I've seen 25 all the way up to 35. It's like, all right, which one is it? It's just an annihilation.
It's a coronation. Like the Belmont was this coronation. It was like he had won the first two events, and everybody went to see him. Like, everyone knew what was happening. It was almost a foregone conclusion that he would win, but no one thought he would win by that. No one thought he would crush the field. I mean, crush the field. And the beauty of it is the Belmont is the longest race, and it's where you've got to build in the extra for your horse. That's why a lot of them fail to make the Triple Crown. They can win the Kentucky Derby on a mile and a quarter. They can win the Preakness at a mile and a half. But at three quarters of a mile, and then it's a mile and a quarter. And then you got to do the mile and a half or whatever the Belmont is. And it's longer. And so horses in the past who have done great at the Kentucky Derby and the Belmont, when they get to Preakness, when they get to the Belmont, it's too long. Secretariat is accelerating as he's coming down the stretch. Mostly horses are hanging on, right? They're hanging on, and he's accelerating and accelerating and accelerating all the way through. I will say that I don't look it to me. It's an event. I'm not putting Secretariat in the athlete category. It's a horse. It's a different kind of thing. But if I'm looking at dominating performances by an individual, not a team, but an individual, then I would put it up there as one of the more important sports events that we've had here in terms of its legacy and its meaning. But if I'm really trying to compare, again, individual sport, individual in a dominating performance, I'm hard pressed to go against what Tiger Woods did at the Open at Pebble Beach. Like, I'm hard pressed to go against that. Like the U.S. Open was an even par thing. If you could get even par, you usually won it. The rough is huge. It's thick. The greens are really fast. They make it nearly impossible. It's the one golf course everyone goes, ugh, I got to complain because I can't make birdies. And Tiger Woods shot like 12 under par.
Yeah.
Like, he completely lapped the field.
The winds are terrible.
Yeah,
they're unpredictable there.
Right. And so when Tiger won in 2000, it was like, this shouldn't exist. This was Secretariat at the Belmont, where everybody was struggling just to get an even par score. This guy's 12 under. Like, it's insane. Like insane. I think he won by 15 that year. And it's like that is Secretariat. That is one individual so far ahead of the field that it's almost unfathomable that this exists. Like we talked, like I just said, Secretariat looks like the lone horse that shouldn't be there. Tiger at the U.S. Open looked like a golfer that was getting the ladies' tees and getting to pick up after, like, you know, like if it got within 15 feet. You know what I mean? Like, it was that. It was not. It's such an outlier to the norm that it's beyond comprehension. But yeah, that happened 50 years ago. And listen, I know horse racing is getting kind of a bum rap these days, what happened at Churchill Downs with a lot of the horses. But if you are a person that is into the sport, you should celebrate this day. I know you're getting a lot of arrows from people like, eh, we got to ban this, blah, blah, blah. Celebrate the excellence of Secretariat. This is one of the most historic dates in horse racing history, and they should celebrate it. It should be a day to really remember that this remarkable thoroughbred who did a remarkable thing at the Belmont 50 years ago. All right, so back to the NBA Finals tonight. I'm going to repeat a little bit what I said in the first segment, in the first monologue, which is I think it is okay to just concede that the Denver Nuggets are a juggernaut basketball team, and maybe this is just too much of an obstacle for Miami to overcome. I think it's okay to do that. Look, I think people don't want to take away from what Miami has done. I think that is the reluctancy on this part. Like for people to think that Denver now should win this in five and they should just simply cruise. I think people are like, well, does that take away from this 8 seed and this magical run? No, it doesn't. It doesn't. Because as I said, I don't think NBA fans are respecting enough of what Denver is and the talent that they have. I don't think Nikola Jokic has been elevated yet to a position where you are almost conceding his excellence to like what Steph Curry had, what LeBron had, what players who were on teams where you would say, you know what, it's going to be really, really hard to beat them. And it's okay if you don't, right? I think that's the thing that is holding us back from embracing the idea that maybe this really is a 1-8 that's a mismatch. Maybe this really is a 1-8 that on paper is playing out the way it should on the court. And I don't want to take anything away from the Heat. They are a team of guts and they are a team of resiliency, I guess. I mean, I don't want to use that term because I don't think, like I said earlier, they're not bouncing back from a lot of situations. But the reality of it is that we're watching something pretty historic in Nikola Jokic. I mean, the guy's a triple-double machine in playing in an era where a big man can get a triple-double because of the way the game is flowing and paying. But look, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was not going to throw out 13 assists in a game, right, back in the day? You get the ball to Kareem, he's skyhooking it into the basket, right? He's not dishing it out. He's not looking to pass. Not a fast pass-first center. But Jokic, that's the way he's building his game. That's going to change the narrative. I'm going to be honest with you. That's going to change the narrative as he gets older and he gets better and better and better about his place in NBA history among centers.
No, and I think we need players like that.
Right.
You know, it kind of reminds me of Magic.
Yeah.
You know, Magic came through. You never had a point guard that was that tall.
That's right. That's right. So, yeah, because you'll have people, you know, Jokic will be in conversation as one of the greatest centers of all time.
Yeah.
But people will say, well, you know, they didn't ask this guy to do what Jokic is doing. And you'd say, okay, I have to concede that a little bit. So he's putting up numbers that other guys didn't want to put up, not that they couldn't put up.
This is Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us. We continue. It's Wake Up Call. Hit us up on Twitter at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That's Ron with two N's. If I'm Miami tonight, I really need Gabe Vincent to be a full participant. In Game 3, he got called for two really, really ticky-tack fouls, almost non-calls. They should have been non-calls. He got into some foul trouble early, and then what was interesting was he went on the bench for a while. When he came back out on the court, they hit him up again with one of those. So he got into foul trouble. He lost a rhythm. You're going to need Gabe Vincent. It can't be the Jimmy Butler, Bam Adebayo show. It has to be Gabe Vincent participating, Caleb Martin participating, Duncan Robbins participating. But I also think that when you're looking at things that Miami has to do to respond, they have to be able to get to rebound, right? They have to be able to be a little bit more aggressive. That was the one thing Spoelstra did not like in Game 3, was that there seemed to be a lack of effort going after loose balls, getting out on defense in certain situations. But I agree with all of that. If the Miami Heat hit their 3-point shots, then this becomes a game because anybody can beat anybody in basketball if you're hitting your 3-point shots. Why is it called the great equalizer? Look, it's the main reason why upsets occur in the NCAA tournament like they are, right? If with the 3-point shot, when you have teams that can do that, there is a way you have to defend that. It takes you out of your game a little bit. And also, again, you're adding more points for every field goal. So, yes, if the Miami Heat come out and shoot 50% from the perimeter again, sure, they can win this game, of course. It'd still be a series. But, again, they're going to need better contributions. And this is the first time, again, outside of two situations, but in both situations, the other team was facing the same thing they were. So when you look at the game against Chicago in the play-in tournament and you look at the game against Boston in Game 7, both them and their opponent were facing elimination. It's not like the Nuggets tonight. The Nuggets are not facing elimination. So this is the first time in the postseason that the Heat have some pressure on them, like that the other team does not have. The Nuggets know, look, even if we lose this, we've got home court advantage back in this series. Yes, it does make our job more difficult, because if we do lose tonight, we are going to have to come back here for Game 6, whether that is with the lead in the series or facing elimination in the series. But we know we are coming back here. But they're not facing elimination. The Heat aren't facing elimination either, but they know that it will be impossible to come back from a 3-1 deficit against a Nuggets team built this way, right? Where they are at a disadvantage. They're at a disadvantage in size, disadvantage in length, right? Talent-wise, the Nuggets are better. So the Heat are going to feel the pressure. Now, what does that mean? Well, if you're Duncan Robinson, it means you better make most of every shot you take. If Caleb Martin, the same thing. If you are who I mentioned earlier, Gabe Vincent. If you are these guys, if Jimmy Butler, every time he drives to the basket, they've got to get points. They cannot just shoot for shooting's sake. If it's a bad look, don't take it. Don't just shoot because you can shoot. They've got to find the best way to shoot. And I think a lot of times Miami was rushed into some shots because I don't think they were as set as they wanted to be in Game 3. And there were times where, like, Lowry would have the ball with like 3 seconds left to shoot, for example, and he's pulling off a fall away jumper from the top of the key that had no chance of going in. I think in this, in tonight's case, Spoelstra is going to have to draw up some things that are allowing good shots, like they had in Game 1 that didn't go down, and like they had in Game 2 that did. But that's the length of Denver. That's how defensively they've been guarding Miami in this series. So, yeah, there are a couple of things Miami can do tonight to get back into this series and maybe win this game. They've got to give the home crowd enough of a feel and enough of an energy. They've got to, if they want to feed off of that, they're going to have to give the crowd something. This was a close game, remember. This was a close back and forth affair in Game 3. That the Nuggets started to pull away a bit in the second quarter and then pulled away a lot in the third. That's where the game had gotten out of hand. And I think Miami, who did a good job in the Jokic, Jamal Murray defense in that process, forgot Christian Brown. So that's what the Nuggets are able to do to you. Now, don't get me wrong. Kentavious Caldwell-Pope and Michael Porter have been terrible. Terrible defensive lapses, terrible on offense, and Brown is taking advantage of that, because when Mike Malone is calling on another person to play in for Michael Porter, who's not playing well in this series, Christian Brown has stepped up and has played well in this series. He was a good spark in Game 2, and he was even better in Game 3. He takes advantage of that situation, but more importantly, he's taking advantage of Miami letting some of Denver's role players a little bit more access while they take care of trying to contain Jokic and Jamal Murray as best as they possibly can. That's the disadvantage that they're at, is that there is somebody else that can contribute to the Denver success. It just hadn't been guys that had been doing that most of the playoffs, Michael Porter Jr. and Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. Both of them have had really bright moments in the postseason, but those moments aren't coming in the NBA Finals. But I go back to the larger picture in all this. I think the Nuggets are a team that is going to be around in the Western Conference for years and years and years. I don't know in the ever-changing landscape of what that conference is becoming, if they keep going to the finals. I have zero idea if this is a dynastic team or not. I don't know. I mean, the Western Conference is changing all the time. You don't know if the Lakers are going to add a piece to make them better. And if they can stay healthy, they'll be a force, even if LeBron is going to be 39. You know the Phoenix Suns have got Kevin Durant, and they're telling Chris Paul that they're going to part ways with him. DeAndre Ayton looks like he's out. How do they get players around those two in Devin Booker and Kevin Durant? Right, Victor Wembanyama may actually be one of the generational talents in this league, and in 3 or 4 years has the Spurs consistently on top of the conference. I don't know. Sacramento doesn't look like it's going away. It's young. It's fast. It's got there's a lot of talent there that is just going to keep getting better, and they're run very well with Michael Brown. So there's a lot of questions about the Western Conference where it's going to change. It's going to look different. There are going to be teams that are going to rise, and there's going to be teams that are going to fall. But I know that if Jokic continues to play and play as well as he has and becomes this ever-present force in the NBA, the Nuggets are going to be in that conversation. No matter what the Western Conference looks like, the Nuggets are going to be in that conversation. So it is very difficult for people to get to grasp around the idea that this is a team that is similar to when Golden State was really good, to when LeBron and, you know, I want to say Miami, but that's, you know that was projected to be very good, and it was. But there are times where the opponent in the NBA, there's one side that is they've got the currency, and Denver, it's hard to look at Denver like that because they haven't been. The Western Conference final run in the bubble was nobody watched it, and then the last two seasons were really underwhelming. So it hasn't been this, wow, they're coming. The Nuggets have been sort of doubted along the way, even though they were the number one seed in the West. The conversation at the beginning of the postseason was more about Kevin Durant's impact with Phoenix. Because, again, they had gone 8-0 during the regular season. LeBron James and the Lakers playing well and getting healthy. Does Golden State have a switch? How real is Sacramento? Is Ja Morant and Memphis ready to pull off a postseason run similar to what they had the year before? There's all these questions, but the real question was, Denver, what exactly are they? What, you know, is this Jokic guy really as good as people say? Because nobody watched him, and nobody sees them. And everyone, you're box scoring with you're basically seeing with your box score rather than your eyes. But next year, if Denver's in the playoffs, maybe we get that feeling for the Nuggets, no matter who they play in the East. But I don't want this to be looked at as a Miami failure. I don't want this to be looked at either at that Miami does this, and this, and they're back in the series. Miami could do all of the things that I mentioned. Gabe Vincent could be hot. They could go after loose balls. They could actually tighten up the rebounding margin, which was so out of whack in game three. They could do all sorts of things. Hit their three-pointers, whatever it is. And the Nuggets could still win this game. They're that good. They're that phenomenal. As I was saying earlier, like, isn't it amazing? I mean, like really process the 30-point triple-double that Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic had. Like, really process it. You never saw that in any NBA game ever? Like, any NBA game where two guys just went off? I mean, look at some of the horrific tanking basketball teams that are out there. And two guys just didn't have fun one night on a Tuesday? Blasting through one of those teams? But the NBA Finals is the biggest stage you can be on, and that's when it happened. Now, I get it. Like, people will say, well, you know, if you're rolling along against a tanking team, usually bench the guys, give them rest, you know, get them out of the game so they can't amass that kind of stat line. All right, I can concede that a little bit. But I've seen some big numbers from guys, you know, during the where they played well into a feasible point in blowouts. But on the biggest stage where the NBA shines the brightest, those two guys put on a show you've never seen before in league history. All right, we're going to talk some baseball coming up next. One team is just being torn apart by its fan base as it's over already. Plus, we'll get some good stuff that's going on in baseball as well as we continue its wake-up call.
Tony D and Ron Culver continues now on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Tony D and Ron Culver.
All right, on Twitter at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That is Ron with two N's. Good, the bad, the dumb coming up in hour number two. So stick around for that. It's your Friday edition as we kick you into the weekend. Then also in hour two, Jared Dubin will join us to talk NBA Finals. Then we got Matt Lombardo in hour three from Heavy.com. We'll talk some NFL. DeAndre Hopkins visiting the Patriots. He visited the Titans. Where will he land? Who wants Dalvin Cook? Because he'll be available. And some other news and notes around the NFL. Did you see how Bryce Young was made QB1 in Charlotte for the Carolina Panthers? Not that surprising, but it's kind of like, I like when teams just go, hey, we're going to do what you all know we're going to do eventually.
Yeah.
Like, we're not playing around.
Just come right out and say it.
Yeah, like, we're not going to get a veteran. He's not going to start week one until our guy is ready.
I saw some great video of Gardner Minshew. I don't know who the second string is in Indianapolis. And Anthony Richardson. There's three quarterbacks. And they were all struggling to put the ball in the net.
Right. Yeah.
And in fact, Anthony Richardson's airmailed it over the net.
Yeah, I'm sure they're excited about that.
They're like 5 or 10 yards away.
I know there's a legitimate NFL debate about this, but I go back to, look, you know what, man? You might as well start day one with the one you fell in love with.
Yep.
You fell in love with this kid. You love him. You drafted him. Like Carolina, you went out and traded for that pick for that particular reason. There's a reason why you did it. That's the kid you wanted. Don't mess around. Don't give the job to somebody nobody wants to see. Don't give the job to somebody that no one thinks is going to win. Give the job to the kid and let him roll out. Now, I know there's the other side of the coin is, you know, the NFL is tough and you can lose a kid's confidence. And if he's out there in week one and he's throwing three picks, and I understand it. I've heard this argument for decades.
But if you're going to lose the kid's confidence, you know, in the first season, then maybe he wasn't the one.
Right. Maybe he wasn't the first round pick you thought he was.
I look at Peyton Manning. You're right. I mean, Peyton Manning started from the moment he set foot in Indianapolis.
That's right.
And still, to this day, holds the record for most interceptions by a rookie.
Yeah, exactly. You want to find a guy with enough fortitude to understand what is he doing?
Yeah.
He's a rookie in the National Football League that is not just one step higher than college football. It's many, many, many steps higher than college football. And if you got a guy that's like, you know what, I'll get this. I'm going to struggle, but I'll get this. And listen, fan bases, there are lunatics, there are fanatics. Don't get me wrong, but I think most fan bases understand when you have a rookie quarterback. What it really means. It means that. Like, I'm a Steelers fan. I know the Steelers make the playoffs a lot, but when they don't make the playoffs, they barely get it. You know, it's like last weekend of the season, that kind of thing. They always take it to the brink. They always take it to the edge, and sometimes they make it, and sometimes they don't. And sometimes they cruise to the postseason, but they never go 2-14, 2-15. But when Kenny Pickett was drafted, I was willing to concede the entire season to his growth. I was willing to go, hey, listen, if you want to go 4-11 or 4-13, if you want to go 4-13 with Kenny Pickett, but I see progress, I'm okay with that because that's what it takes in this league. Now, the Steelers took it to the edge last year when he took over the job, and that was a surprise. They didn't finish with a losing record. But the reality is that most teams and most people are okay with an initial struggle with a rookie QB because the long-term play is that he'll get better. So if I'm Carolina, good job. Good job not wasting everybody's time with giving the job to some veteran nobody wants to see. Like, who wants that? If you're a Carolina fan, you're like, no, it's best. No, this is best. Let him sit behind so-and-so journeyman who's been bouncing around the league for the last 8 years. Like, that's not a good thing. Start him, play him. Bill Parcells did this years and years ago, 30 years ago, with the Patriots. They drafted Drew Bledsoe. I think Scott Zolak was on the roster. Bledsoe started day one. Day one. That's the guy. This is the guy we want. This is the guy who gets the job. That's it. We're not playing around. We're not goofing off. This is the guy who gets it. So congratulations, Carolina, for making the right decision with Bryce Young. All right, baseball. Everybody in New York is losing their mind to get with the Mets. And it's over. There is no way they're coming back. The season is done. Thanks, Mets, for the promise of nothing. And they lost 6 in a row. They lost 3 games to the Toronto Blue Jays last weekend and then went to Atlanta and lost 3 straight to the Braves, including last night where Ozzie Albies hit a walk-off 3-run homer and rallied from a 6-4 deficit late in the game. No, 6-3 deficit late in the game. and the Mets blow it. They blew it with Justin Verlander on the mound last night. Or it was Max Scherzer. I can't remember who was pitching last night, but it was one of those two old aces that they are trying to utilize as the 1-2 combination to get themselves a World Series championship. But both of them are pretty mediocre right now. And if I'm a Mets fan, yeah, I'm not liking this. They're 8.5 games back. And Miami is ahead of them, and Philadelphia is ahead of them. And is anybody healthy that's playing for the Phillies these days? They're all healthy now? Because, man, the beginning of the season was a whole bunch of guys not playing. So the Mets are 3 games below 500, and everybody's losing it. Everyone's losing it.
Well, especially against this series against the Braves, too.
It could have been a critical changing series for them.
Well, it could have been a sweep for the Mets.
They were leading in every game.
And leading in every game. Yeah, I think there was one, somebody threw up a stat. They were like in the 75 percentile to win the game.
Yeah.
In each of the games. Like, that's how much they were leading. It wasn't just like, oh, we're up by a run or two. You know, it was like, no, there was a clear, definite pathway for them to win the game with ease.
And Buck Showalter, didn't he win Manager of the Year last year? Or was he in the running for it or something like that? And it's the team. I don't blame him. Steve Cohen has dumped a bunch of money into this as a fantasy baseball owner. Like, he's playing fantasy baseball. Like, how do I get this guy? How do I get this guy? How do I get this guy? And they're 3 games below 500. That's absolutely terrible. And here's the funny thing about the National League. I mean, again, we're adding more teams in the playoffs, but some of these teams are pretty surprising. I don't know how much longer some of these teams are going to make it. Like, when we talked to Steve Gardner about this, and I said, my God, are like the Pirates for real? Am I supposed to be like all into them now? And he's like, yeah, but you know what happens in the summer? You know, it eventually dies out.
Yep.
But once you pass Memorial Day, I think there is a point where you start saying, you know, maybe this is this team. Maybe the Pirates are a team that can score some runs. They get pretty good pitching from their team. They don't have a huge ace or anything like that, but they're getting good enough outings that they might be a team that will be kicking around. Who knows? And maybe the St. Louis Cardinals turn on the Jets. But you, like the Mets, they're so far back and playing so badly, you can't see
it. And that's what I was pointing at. It's like there's, you know, to that point, I don't think the Diamondbacks are going to be the leaders of the NL West at the end of the season.
Yeah, but you could see them in the playoffs.
I could see them in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, they're like 12 games above 500.
I can see the Dodgers turning it on, though, and like catching up. I don't think the Cardinals catch up.
No, I don't think the Cardinals catch up at all.
They're a shock.
Their pitching is terrible. Yeah. Their pitching is terrible.
But then, you know, teams that haven't been there in a while that are there, like the Texas Rangers, don't surprise me.
Yeah,
they literally went out and bought people.
They did. They got a new manager, new general manager. They really cleaned house. They went and said, look, we're going to go out and we're going to go sign people. We're going to go shopping. We've got some money. We got a new ballpark. Everything's rosy. We're going to go out there and do it. We're going to go out there and get it. You know, look, I still think like a team like Houston, as good as they are, is a team to beat because I think in the postseason, they have a way of playing in the postseason. I think is the art. But
banging trash cans.
Banging trash cans. Wink, wink. But, yeah, you're right. You're right about a team like Arizona. Right now, they're leading the division, right? They're playing very good baseball. And there are going to be some people going, all right, what happened to the Padres? And again, we have a lot of baseball left, but some of the disappointments are not helping themselves by putting themselves in these holes going into July. Like, in about 3 weeks, we're going to be heading into July. And at that point, if you find yourself double digits down in the division and you are 7, 8, 9 games below 500 so that your wild card chances are hurt, you're in trouble. You better fix it. You better find a way to make a run in baseball. And we know baseball comes in waves. You can win 5 and then lose 3, and then you could lose 2 and win 4. It comes in waves. But what happens is if your opponent is doing the exact same thing, you're not making up ground. Like we talked about the Mets. The Mets went into this series against Atlanta, 5.5 back in the division. Now, again, way too early to be talking about divisional races. I get it. But imagine if they had swept all of those games. If they had closed out with their bullpen all 3 of those games, they'd be sitting today 3.5 back. Now they're like, okay, like we were talking about a horse race. We're setting ourselves up early. We're putting ourselves on the rail. We're putting ourselves in the middle of the pack. We're pacing well. It's not about getting to the front and racing out to the front. It's putting yourselves in, hey, by the end of June, let's be here. Like, we don't have to win the division yet. Like, let's be here. And those games are important. And by the way, Tampa Bay is starting to pull away now from the rising Baltimore Orioles nobody seems to be paying attention to. All right, we'll continue hour two next.